morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today is Tuesday, March 24th, 2009, and this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Secretary of State Kate Brown wants to clean up Oregon's petition mill.
While other newspapers around Greater Cascadia are folding, the Oregonian is digging in for the duration.
And President Obama rolls out his plan to save us from ourselves, or at least from the Republicans.
Portland area weather, cool and damp, showers, temperatures in the 40s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, rain, lows in the mid-30s to lower 40s, and then tomorrow, more of the same.
And first we go to regional news from around Cascadia. As the nation staggers from foreclosure to foreclosure, more people are imagining themselves saying to hell with the whole system and building their own house. And there are others who are beyond the imagination stage and are actually doing that. For these builders, cob structures make the most sense in so many ways. My guest this morning builds cob houses and can teach you to do so also. He has in hand a local enterprise that is all about cob building. Welcome, Scott Howard. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, first off, can you tell listeners what exactly a cob house is? There are a lot of people out there who think it's maybe made out of corn cobs.
Yeah, that is a common misunderstanding. Cob is a word that comes from Wales and refers to an earthen material made of sand and clay and straw. That word has been popularized in the Northwest also by a cob cottage company. A guy came over from Wales and is now teaching in the Northwest. He's inspired a lot of people. His name is Yanto Evans. And there are a number of other wall systems that are very similar to cob all around the world. So right now, we're using cob as sort of the catch-all phrase for all of these systems. People often recognize it in Portland.
So what are the advantages of a cob structure, a cob house?
There are a lot of advantages. I'd say, firstly, the material itself comes from the site where you're building. That's the number one thing. So you're saving a lot of energy in transporting materials. And also, cob is really great at absorbing the sun's energy throughout the day. So buildings tend to heat themselves. And also, they last a really long time. If you give your cob house a good set of boots and a really good hat to protect it from the elements, then those earthen walls will last hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
And cost? Suppose you wanted to build, you know, a cottage, say, I don't know, 1,000 square feet or less. Could you do that, and what would it cost?
That is the first question that everyone asks me these days, and I'm doing everything I can to offer small earthen buildings at a competitive price to these modern prefabricated materials. Excuse me. And so I believe that my buildings are competitive with these modern materials in cost, which is something that's very difficult to do because the costs are artificially low for these materials, which actually tax our environment and our ecosystems. So building with earth is many times more efficient than building with these other materials such as wood, because you're saving the environment, you're saving the transportation costs of materials, and you're also using less machine and more human power.
And we don't seem to have come to terms exactly with what you're talking about, the subsidized costs, the fact that we maintain a vast standing army so we have enough oil to produce fuel to go get all of these things. Now we've cut down most of our forests as well without that cob structure.
I sure can. I'm offering a weekend workshop series this spring in May and June and July. And I'm inviting everyone to attend. I'm offering it on the weekends for people who work during the week, and you can attend some of those workshops or all of them. Please go to my website at www.earthenhand.com. That's earthen as in made of earth, And I'm offering a number of other workshops also. There's one weekend just for the basics of Cobb, and then the workshop series actually covers start to finish, from foundations all the way through a living roof, so you can learn all the parts of constructing your own Cobb house.
And they're beautiful, too. They're beautiful structures.
Yeah, and that's really what drew me to it in the first place, was the artistic possibilities of this sculptural architecture and the beauty, all of that, the expression.
So you're living inside a beautiful piece of handmade sculpture, really. Well, Scott, thank you so much. My guest has been Scott Howard of Earth in Hand. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much, Chris.
The Oregon Environment Council is staging a series of low-impact development workshops in Oregon's growing communities. The workshops cover sustainable stormwater management practices to protect watersheds from urban runoff. They target builders, developers, engineers, elected officials, and others involved in urban planning and development.
The Oregonian newspaper said yesterday that it will keep publishing. But there are going to be cost reduction measures that include pay cuts, furloughs, and layoffs of part-time employees to keep the company profitable in a difficult economic climate. Whatever you think of the Oregonian, this is a positive sign that Cascadia still values newsprint.
With Intel sales plummeting and its shares trading at 1997 levels, 99% of employees' stock options are worthless. So the company said yesterday that it wants to offer workers a bailout of sorts. Intel proposed allowing employees to exchange their underwater stock options for fewer options at a lower exercise price. If shareholders approve, the company hopes to restore options incentive value at a time when it's freezing pay across the company, cutting jobs and trimming other perks.
Well, it's a start. Shame on you, Oregon. It's time to turn in your green card. The U.S. Forest Service has awarded more contracts funded by federal economic stimulus funds to reduce wildfire danger in Oregon, and that means logging. And at a time when there is no market for lumber, so where's the stimulus in that? The Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest announced today that it is going to hand out a contract to Lomat Katsi Restoration Project. Grayback Forestry of Merlin and Diamond Fire in Sutherland also are recipients of stimulus handouts.
Oregon has one of the least restrictive citizen ballot initiative systems in the country. Secretary of State Kate Brown said yesterday that she wants it to be one of the cleanest also. Brown sent lawmakers a proposal that would require signature gatherers to register and take a training course earlier in the process. Also, signatures would be tossed if found to have been collected by somebody convicted of fraud, forgery, or identity theft.
And this one is just sad. Medford job seeker Joshua Berger figured he had to do something to make his resume stand out from the pack. So he tricked himself out with a sandwich board sign listing his qualifications. Berger spent one day last week advertising himself at a busy Medford intersection. Did the tactic work? Berger, who was laid off in January from his job as an airplane engine mechanic, has been invited to interview this week for a dispatcher position with the Veterans Affairs Domiciliary Police Force. Way to go, Berger.
Killing is their business, and business is good. In hard times, military recruiting is like shooting fish in a barrel. This year, more Oregon Army National Guard soldiers will head for war than at any time since World War II. And more people are signing up and re-enlisting than ever. Oregon posted a record high number of recruits in February as enlistments also rose nationally. The Oregon Guard also led all states for reenlistments last month, with 208 soldiers re-upping.
The Pacific Northwest was once a guiding light in the labor movement. Not so now. In Washington, a union-friendly bill was killed amid political controversy. The argument was that the mandatory meeting bill would not have become law anyway because of negative effects on the Boeing Company. Boeing and other business interests lobbied hard to oppose the measure.
In Idaho, seven former administrators of the Palouse Ranger District are blasting a U.S. Forest Service plan to trade 28,000 acres of managed forests for about 39,000 acres of logged-over timber company land in northern Idaho. John Krebs, a retired Forest Service employee, said the plan is fundamentally flawed because much of the public land has been carefully managed for the public's use.
Is it just me, or does it seem like Oregon sort of falling behind in its green credentials? Secretary of State Kate Brown is looking to further regulate Oregon's initiative process. Questions concerning... We had this story just a moment ago. Go ahead, Liam.
You better watch your crabs. Crab theft has hit Oregon. An Oregon skipper has pleaded guilty to stealing 175 commercial crab pots at the close of last year's Dungeness crab season. Besides charge of theft and aggravated theft, Perry Canuri pleaded guilty to one count of wasting 610 pounds of crab.
It's desperation all around. President Obama has a plan to fix the economy by fixing schools, health care, and capping out and trading our way to a better environment. So far, the markets like it, despite the rabid, foaming-at-the-mouth response of the Republican pundits. The only trouble is that this is a delicate, dangerous move, and if anything at all goes wrong, Democrats, meaning, of course, Barack Obama, will be left holding the bag of GOP poo. KBOO Spencer Raymond has been studying this strange phenomena for at least a week now. Good morning, Spencer. What do you make of this week and the market's response to the political scene?
Yeah, good morning, Chris. Well, the Dow has just made an unbelievable gain in the last 10 days, about 500 points up just in that time span. And it really was what capped off yesterday with a big game after Obama and his administration announced plans to put $1 trillion towards buying those troubled assets, these things that we've been talking about all along that have created these problems. And Wall Street is loving it. Today, not so much. It's down about 24 points. Right now, but it looks like Wall Street is sold on this idea of using the government money to buy the troubled assets. And let's talk about that a little more. These troubled assets are the things, that's the best way to describe them, that the banks own that are basically bad possessions in a monetary sense. Because they have those, that lowers the value of the bank and it makes them much less desirable as lenders. And so if the banks can get rid of these, by the government buying them, for instance, as the Obama administration is planning, then the banks can look better on paper, they can act better, and then they can ultimately become become lenders easier, and people will want to borrow from them because the banks look more trustworthy. But, Chris, I think the bottom line here is that it took a while for these bailouts to be rolled through, for the Obama plan to be really made public, and for a long time Wall Street was not a fan of this, but yesterday, as I said, this $1 trillion proposal, the guys down in New York are liking it.
And it seems, too, that where it looked for a moment that, like, Wall Street was driving policy in Washington, D.C., it now there's been a bit of a turn. That was last week was... Not a good moment for people who like to believe that really government is doing the best that it can. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has asked Congress today for broad new powers to regulate non-bank financial companies like AIG. That's something that do not have time to get into right now. We'll talk about that tomorrow. That, of course, was KBOO Spencer Raymond. Thanks so much for that, Spencer.
Thanks, Chris.
A Detroit couple accused of trying to cremate their slain 2-year-old son on a barbecue grill and then collecting his welfare benefits have pleaded guilty in a deal with prosecutors. No word on whether the couple plan to use the barbecue again next season. This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Tuesday, March 24, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Janet Anderson. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. Greg Palast on the anniversary of the Exxon Valdez spill and the economic meltdown, and a short interview with Malik Rahim of the Common Ground Relief.
Thanks so much for listening and have a good day.
Today on Flashpoint, we'll have a special report on the spill of the Exxon Valdez 20 years after it devastated Williams Sound and destroyed indigenous life and culture there. Also, an update on Obama's response to the economy and Wall Street meltdown. We'll be joined in the studio with the founder of Common Ground Relief, Malik Rahim, to talk about the growing poverty and the continuing battle to rebuild the Lower Ninth Ward. And we'll feature an excerpt from yesterday's People's Tribunal on the police murder of Oscar Grant. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. It's been 20 years since the Exxon Valdez went aground in Alaska, devastating 1,200 miles or more of Alaska's pristine coastline with toxic oil. Quote, it also marks the 20th year of a lie, writes Greg Palast on gregpalast.com, quote, lots of lies. Greg Palast is one of the key investigators over 18 years ago working with the indigenous population to hold Exxon accountable, but it wasn't to be. And 20 years later, the devastation of the spill is still being felt, and Exxon has been virtually let off the hook. Joining us to talk about Exxon and give us an update on Wall Street meltdown bailout is Greg Palast. He's the author, among other things, of Armed Madhouse and the editor of GregPalast.com. He reports for the BBC. Greg, it is good to have you back with us.
Always, Dennis. Always glad to be with you.
Well, let's go back to the, let's shoot back to the beginning. Right up top there, Exxon Valdez said the first thing was it wasn't going to be a big problem because the good weather and good conditions essentially wiped the spill away.
Oh, yeah. Mother Nature took care of it all. According to the lazy, well, I won't use the word, the lazy something reporters who don't go up to the Prince William Sound to look at the oil. If they did, you know, kick over rocks over near Chinega on Sleepy Bay, and it still smells like a gas station. It's 20 years later, man. It's, the damage is still there. Mother Nature doesn't wipe your poop for you so easily, especially with the geology of Alaska. And the evil crime, it's like, it's kind of ecological Holocaust denial. Exxon just says it doesn't exist. Mother Nature cleaned it up. That's it. If you go to GregPalast.com, you will in fact see masses of oil cleanup being done by guys in yellow suits. Those are natives, local natives cleaning up their beaches in hazmat suits. Those pictures were taken 7 years after the spill by my BBC crew. And but, you know, Exxon just said no more cleanups after 7 years just because they didn't want the PR and figured no one would care anymore. What, the governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, is going to care about what happens to the natives there? She won't even accept unemployment insurance compensation from the federal government, let alone trying to do something for the people who live in the sludge today.
Let's talk about how bad it was then, why it was so bad and got a lot worse based on Exxon's lack of action and preparedness, and what the devastation is that continues.
Well, first of all, let's start out with their lies. I mean, one of the big stories that always comes out is that there's a captain, a guy named Hazelwood, who is drunk and he ran the boat onto a reef, you know, kind of like a drunk driver at the wheel. That's just complete baloney, Dennis. He was stewed. So was the first mate and the second mate. But they were below deck sleeping it off when the third mate was at the helm. But he's flying the boat, this giant tanker, without the Raycast radar system. Raycast was like the early version of GPS, you know, where you could see even a three-year-old could have taken the tanker through the Valdez Narrows if the radar was on. But it was at that time, wasn't a $200 GPS. Those things at that time cost millions to build and to operate, train. So Exxon, after the maiden voyage of the ship, just turned, kept, it didn't work, so they kept it off and turned it off, which is against the law, by the way. It's like having, you know, no speedometer or something. And so that's why the ship hit the reef. Even then, however, I should note that that would not have caused the disaster that we saw. The disaster was caused not only by Exxon's cheaping out on the radar, but even more, by saving millions and millions, even billions of dollars on safety equipment to contain a spill. Tankers hit reefs, they run aground, they spring leaks all the time, Dennis, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean that you end up, you know, sludging and sliming 1,000 miles of coastline. What you do, it's real simple. You put a rubber boom, like a, just a big rubber skirt around the ship and its oil, and then you suck it out with a pump into another ship. Well, Exxon promised that they're going to run the water route, which they didn't have to do. If they're going to take oil by water, that they would leave this rubber skirts, these rubber booms, out all over the sound, including right at the place where they hit Bligh Reef, you know, named after Captain Bligh. They were actually supposed to keep equipment right there at the native village, and where if a tanker ever hit there, they could just surround it with the rubber skirt. So it should have been nothing. But there was no rubber skirt there, and there was no ship to suck out the extra stuff that's called a containment ship, because Exxon, despite saying they would never run a tanker without the containment vessel nearby, they ran it anyway, even though the containment vessel was out of commission. It was in a dry dock, and the stuff was locked under ice, the pumps. So you had no radar. Once the ship hit, they had no rubber to contain the oil, which is simple stuff. But, you know, they didn't do it because they figured, well, who's going to check for equipment out in the Prince William Sound except natives, right? They didn't have the ship ready to go, the emergency containment ship. And so you added those things together. Plus, and I got to tell you, that's your disaster, but even worse. And here's the ugly, ugly thing, Dennis. It was a crime. And I don't mean that. That's not a metaphor. Before I was a journalist, I was a racketeering investigator. This was criminal activity. I'm not kidding. I use that advisedly. In April 1988, according to my investigation, you know, it's a team. I'll give credit to many people on this. We found memos 10 months before the spill in which Exxon and the oil company chiefs, their chief guy in Alaska, a guy named Theodore Polasek, wrote the chief of Exxon and the chief of British Petroleum, which is their partner, Arco Petroleum, part of British Petroleum, and said, we don't have the equipment that we need that's basically required by law in case there's a spill in the Prince William Sound. And Arco said, well, then, if that's the law, they're British, they figure, okay, well, I guess you got to comply. And Exxon vetoed it. Exxon adamantly vetoed spending the money to put out equipment required by law. So what their guys did is they simply signed papers saying the equipment was there. This was the top guys. This was, you're talking the presidents and CEOs of the oil companies meeting in Arizona, April 1988, 10 months before the spill, saying, forget it, we're not going to have any spill equipment up there. 10 months later, the spill happened. That's like, has racketeering conspiracy written all over it, Dennis. All over it.
We're speaking with Greg Palast. We're talking about the 20th anniversary, if you will, of the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska that destroyed hundreds of miles of the Alaska coastline and really went a long way to destroy a way of life, Greg. I guess tomorrow's the 20th anniversary. People are still being devastated and undermined by this action. Who was hurt? Tell us about the people you met and who was hurt on this kind of spill and who is still being hurt.
I actually worked for the Chugach Native Alaskans who, you know, this is native land. It's their islands and their beaches that were destroyed. But you have to understand, it wasn't just, you know, you're not talking about Malibu, where there was, by the way, a spill. We're not talking about G or Summer House. These people have lived there for 3,000 years. They're the last people in America to actually survive off the land and where they live. And they lived off seal. They lived off clams that they got, deer, etc. It was all poisoned, destroyed. The seals were of course, poisoned and died. One native elder, Henry McCarker, was telling you about an otter who just, he watched an otter just with burning his eyes, bring a hive kite and gouge out its own burning eyes. You know, the deer would eat the poison vegetation and die. Eagles were dying because they were eating the poisoned salmon. It was devastation. And when the president of Exxon came for a photo op to the village saying, we're going to take care of everything, Paul Komkoff, a native seal hunter, said, you know, I'm hungry. You guys are dropping McDonald's foods from helicopters. What is that? I mean, where's my seal meat? So they sent in canned seal meat, which was marked not fit for human consumption because it was zoo food. And, you know, these villages have never recovered because the poison was there for years and years and years. Some of the natives were also commercial fishermen. And, of course, who wants, you know, 90-octane salmon? So they went bankrupt. They lost their boats. And Exxon has refused to pay after 20 years. And there was a court judgment against them, $5 billion, which was supposed to go to 30,000 people. And the Supreme Court this past year, the Bush court, John Roberts said, well, you know, why are you picking on Exxon, and cut it by 90%? So now after 20 years, people are getting finally their checks, 10 cents on the dollar. So welcome to corporate America. And the president of Exxon, by the way, retired, that was in charge of this fraud, really, received a $400 million bonus on his retirement. I mean, everyone's shaking up about AIG. That's twice of all the AIG bonuses combined.
And this treachery by Exxon was premeditated and quite conscious in terms of its brutality all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand. It's not they said, oh, let's have a spill. What they said is, we can save. See, that's the whole thing. This is a profit center. To maintain spill equipment, emergency response teams. They used to hire the natives to go with the tankers because they knew the waters. And they were trained to deal with spills. They had a lot of technical expertise. They knew the waters. They fired all the natives. They got rid of the equipment. They didn't have the containment barges. They refused to have double-hulled boats, which would have also prevented the damage. They saved billions. And when they even had, they would lobby their way out of laws like double-hulled tankers. But even when the law said, they made promises under oath, the top guys at Exxon and British Petroleum and its ARCO unit swore. You're talking about the chairman and CEOs and presidents swore to Congress under oath that they would have spill equipment, that they would maintain the state-of-the-art radar. That was under oath. And they had state-of-the-art radar, but it was off. You know, so yes, what was premeditated was the penny pinching, or billions of pennies, of course, billions of penny pinching operations, which led to the disaster, and they didn't care because it was like, to them, it's the cost, what they ultimately paid. Now there's 10 cents on the dollar payoff. That's like a license to pollute. As far as they're concerned, it's a license to pollute. If after 20 years, hey, we pay a few bucks. They even told me, Otto Harrison, and I want you to remember his name because I like to name these people. It's not just an empty corporation. General manager of Exxon USA said, hey, you know, we'll outlive you. And they did. Paul Komkoff, the seal hunter, is dead. You know, what's the point of giving him a check now?
Outlive them, huh? Outlive the victim and celebrate your retirement on the backs of entire communities. It does sound like corporate life as usual. Is there any way, is there anything to do, or is this now, as they say, dirty water under the bridge?
Well, a couple things. One, Mr. Obama, he got maneuvered into agreeing to some new offshore drilling, expanded offshore drilling during the McCain-Palin oil panic, you know, drill, baby, drill, okay? And Obama said, okay, well, we'll open up some more coastal waters to drilling, supposedly because we have new safeguards. Well, we heard about those safeguards before the Exxon Valdez. All the safeguards were there. They lie. They still lie. I mean, I just came back from Ecuador, where, you know, Chevron Texaco's pooped all over the Amazon. Please just look at Louisiana. I mean, my God, you know, I mean, yeah, they know how to prevent oil spills. They know how to prevent oil pollution, just that it costs money, and they're not going to spend it ever. Forget it. It won't happen. You know, and they'll never enforce the law because the other aspect of this, and this is not a side issue. You know, as a senator, Obama was a supporter of so-called tort reform, you know, preventing people from filing class action lawsuits, the evil lawyers. Well, you know, I got those documents. I have to tell you, I got those documents about the secret meeting of Exxon and the other oil chiefs before the spill through the legal process, through the Native's lawsuit. They were seeking justice. They were seeking compensation, and we forced Exxon to open its files. And, you know, yeah, we didn't get the money for the Natives that they deserved, but we got a lot of the truth. And that's only because of the right to sue, the right to bring class actions. And I'm just afraid that last route of justice is being shut down by corporate America. And I'm just afraid that Obama is going to give into this crap, as he did as a senator, that evil lawyers are filing too many lawsuits against corporations. That's nonsense. There's not enough.
We're speaking with Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. He's a reporter for the BBC and author of a number of books. One you may remember is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy on Madhouse. And, Greg, I want to turn your attention to the ongoing bailout and the Wall Street meltdown.
Yes.
A lot of stuff coming up on AIG. I want to read you just a little bit of Paul Krugman's article that came out today, or was it yesterday, whatever, when it was syndicated. And I want to have you respond to what the hell is going on behind the scenes here. Krugman's writing, over the weekend, the Times and other newspapers reported leaked details about the Obama administration's bank rescue plan, which is to be officially released this week. If the reports are correct, Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, has persuaded President Obama to recycle Bush administration policy, specifically the cash for trash plan proposed, then abandoned 6 months ago by then Treasury Secretary Paulson. This is more than disappointing. In fact, it fills me with a sense of despair. You want to talk about why Tim Geithner might be inspired to keep cash and trash?
Well, okay. First of all, let me mention that I actually have some qualifications to do this. I certainly know Krugman because I was a forensic economist. That's how I ended up doing the Exxon investigation and, studied under, of all people, Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago. But this whole area of finance, of course, is one in which I have expertise in regulation of industry. And this is the problem. You know, we have a government that's afraid to govern. They're still doing the kind of Reaganite government is the problem issue. You know, like, oh, my God, we won't take over the banks. We want the, you know, we will let the, I think it was Summers who was still talking about the wisdom of the market. The wisdom of the market, my God. You know, okay, enough with the wisdom of the market and Wall Street. I mean, we have a big problem here in that we know what to do. Krugman knows what to do. Joe Stiglitz, another, who's, by the way, Krugman's, you know, we identified him as a columnist. He's a Nobel Prize winning economist. And, Joe.
Sorry
Stiglitz,
about that, Paul.
Okay, that's okay. I mean, he's proud of being in a,
everybody knows
too.
By now, huh?
And, you know, I mean, we know what to do. There's no, you know, this is not, actually, it's not rocket science. The idea, like, what do we do is baloney. Because we've been through this drill before in the Depression. Okay, in the first depression, this is the second one, this is the not-so-great depression. But in the Great Depression, we figured it out. Franklin Roosevelt called a bank holiday, which is a very nice, polite word. It wasn't like Club Med. The bank holiday was shuttering every bank in America and saying, now, if you reopen, here's the terms under which you will reopen. We're taking over. Here's what you can do and what you can't do. And first, the gambling operations end. You know, this whole idea... You know, people are talking about bonuses for these knuckleheads, greedy knuckleheads that blew all this money. Why do, you know, and we're afraid that we'll lose these people. Why do banks even have these gambling departments? It only occurred after 1998 when Bill Clinton and Robert Rubin and Larry Summers pushed for and won the destruction of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was Franklin Roosevelt's law, which prevented commercial banks from being involved in investment banking gambling, which is basically gambling on securities. It couldn't be done until 1998. It was against the law. What these guys are getting bonuses for used to get jail time. So that changed in 1998. So it's real simple. If we end the law against speeding and there's dead bodies all over the highway, I would say you put back up the speeding signs. We put back the rule that you cannot gamble. If you're going to be pouring money into banks, you have to stop them from gambling it away. And we saw that, by the way, with Merrill Lynch. We saw that Merrill Lynch and Bank of America were given $25 billion of bailout money, $25 billion. And within 3 months, they lost $15 billion of it gambling in the market. Why did they go to Vegas with our treasury money? $25 billion, $15 billion lost in 3 months. So that has to end. That has to end. And what we need to do is now take over the banks, make sure that the money we put in is lent out. That's the point. The economy is frozen because the banks are taking the money, paying bonuses, but not lending it back out to the system. So what you do to lend it back out to the system is you tell the banks, you're getting the money, and you lend it back out in the system. What instead Geithner's trying to do is say, well, if we take the bad bets of the banks, so-called toxic assets, and the American public swallows the toxic assets, if we eat their losses, then they'll be free to feel comfortable to go out and loan again. No, they'll be free to go out and gamble again. There won't be an end to this. We saw that. I mean, Merrill Lynch, on the verge of bankruptcy, gambled double or nothing, and we lost. So what Krugman is objecting to is the idea that we have an endless pocket to pay off their bad debts with no promise, none whatsoever in return, that they're going to loan money out and keep the economy going. That is Krugman's fear, that this is not only a bad idea and an unfair idea, it's an idea that won't work. And you can't just take these guys' bad assets, buy them off, and then say that they'll go back to good banking, lending money for businesses and home mortgages again. They're not interested in that. You don't get big bonuses off that. You don't make a $100 million bonus off of, you know, lending for someone for inventory at the local drugstore. That's what banks got to go back to. They don't want to do it. We have to take them over and nationalize them and tell them that you don't go back into private business until you get out of the gambling business.
You know, Greg, we're waiting for Malik Rahim to arrive at the studios. I know that you know the work of
Yes.
Common Ground and what the struggle has been like in the Lower Ninth Ward.
And all over New Orleans, but yeah, the Lower Ninth.
Well, you want to talk about how you see that in the current context of the Wall Street meltdown? I mean, does it mean that essentially what was bad is going to be a lot worse for these people until the next hurricane comes and just simply washes them away totally?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, oil, you can't tell the story of New Orleans without telling the story of oil. In fact, you know, I did a film called Big Easy to Big Empty with Malik Rahim about the destruction of New Orleans. And it was once again the repeat of that same Exxon story. The Bush administration had privatized the evacuation planning of New Orleans, privatized, put out for sale, no big contract to cronies. And so their evacuation plan for New Orleans was no evacuation plan at all. So 1,800 people drowned. I mean, I couldn't even find their evacuation plan. I asked FEMA, where's the evacuation plan? They said, we don't know. I said, how do you evacuate people if you don't know? And then later they said, no, we know it, but it's confidential, because, you know, FEMA is part of Homeland Security. They said, how can you have a confidential evacuation plan? You know, and the answer is, well, you can't. That's so people drown. They knew this in advance. Once again, like the secret meetings of Exxon saying, we're not going to prepare, the Bush administration was warned. They were warned by the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center that the levees were short, that the Army Corps of Engineers, playing, rebuilding Iraq for the Iraqis, and then blowing up their bridges and rebuilding them when they were needed to rebuild the levees. They were warned in advance. They were warned that there was no evacuation plan in advance. And now today, New Orleans is still remains, in effect, underwater economically. More than half the original population of New Orleans, that is the pre-flood population, has never returned, and they love it. That's why you have a smarmy little jerk like Bobby Jindal as governor, because they literally washed away the Democratic voters who never returned.
Amazing. And shouldn't we, I mean, people don't have their hopes too high. You're one of those, Greg. But shouldn't an administration like Obama, if they're going to be able to make a little dent in anything, shouldn't we see their concern in this context?
Well, you know, we see a little. It's a tough one for me. You know, I'm always disappointed in these guys. That's my job as an investigative reporter. I don't expect much, and I didn't from Obama. But even in Alaska, you've got the governor of Alaska, Palin. You know, Dear Sarah, saying that she won't accept the unemployment compensation funds that Obama has, that Obama's administration is trying to provide. So you've got the problem that, and in Louisiana, you've got Jindal, who does not want to rebuild New Orleans, because that means bringing back the black voters who would never vote for that guy. So why is he? They're not going to rebuild New Orleans for the people that live there. That ain't going to happen. So, Do I expect Obama to overcome that? I don't think he can. Does he have the will? Well, we see that you've got Geithner begging on his knees. He's got a Secretary of the Treasury, which is where the action is. He's got a Secretary of the Treasury who's saying he can't restrict the banks because then they won't accept the bailout money. Can you imagine? I don't remember Franklin Roosevelt and his Treasury Secretary, Henry Wallace, begging the banks. I remember that, bring them into a room and saying, here's what's going to happen, guys, or we'll let the crowds rip your arms off. We'll throw you out in the street, you know, and let the people take care of you. We have a nation on its knees where we need spending in the economy to bring it back to life, and there could be no better place to spend it than New Orleans. That's why Jindal does not want that money. Okay, and whether Obama does not know how to pull out the whip and make them do the right thing, even though the public is waiting for that. Krugman's complaint is that unless Obama acts, and even Frank Rich, who's another columnist, who's in love with Obama, but he said this is his Katrina moment, actually. Frank Rich said, this is Obama's Katrina moment. He's missing it. People are angry. And in a way, the anger is good. This is the moment for someone like a Huey Long to step forward. I'd like to see Obama take on a little more Huey Long and say, we must do this, or I will go to each of your states and campaign against you, Democrat or Republican. We're not going to beg the banks anymore. We're going to tell the banks. It's our money. And it goes beyond bonuses.
All right, we're going to leave it right there, Greg Palast. Greg Palast, gregpalast.com, with BBC, the best money democracy can buy. That's still the big problem in this system. Greg, as always, a pleasure to have you with us. And whenever you're in town, please look us up.
You got it, Dennis. And go to gregpalast.com, and we're going to have a new film out, Palast Investigates, with the BBC Films, the BBC Reports, which we'll be watching next week, the BBC Reports that you're not allowed to see on U.S. TV. Then you'd know these stories.
I really appreciate
the platform you've given us. Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you very much, Greg, for the great information. Appreciate it. and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. On Sunday, March 22nd, Revolution Books and the Bay Area Revolution Club held a People's Tribunal in Oakland to examine the police murder of Oscar Grant III and countless others. Activists, an academic, former BART employee, the author of the book Stolen Lives, and many families spoke to share their experience and learnings from being the victims of police abuse and or confronting the issue. Here's a little excerpt of that hearing. Thanks.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Victoria Smith, and I'm Oscar's auntie and John Tu's mom, Oscar's best friend. I wanted to let you know that the family want to thank everyone who's helped in Oscar, supporting him, supporting the family. They thank all of you. They can't be here today. And as a family member, I thank you. And as an auntie to the other boys that were on the platform, we thank you too. We're here today to prove that Oscar was killed in cold blood by Officer Miserable. New Year's night at the Fruitvale BART station. We're asking everybody to please help put Officer Miserable away for killing Oscar, for destroying his friends, minds, souls, young men who will never be the same, that watched their best friends be executed in cold blood. Helplessly they watched, and they couldn't help him. Helplessly I watched from home in my bed, and I couldn't help none of the boys. So we just ask everyone to stand with us, help us with this. These are young men, 22 years of age, whose lives have all going to be now changed because of their best friend, Oscar Grant. Oscar, who was a great father, someone who's been in my life since he was about 5 years old, lived with me, loved his auntie's cooking. Let me keep his baby when he needed a babysitter. It's just so much I can say about Oscar. His protection of his auntie. He didn't like nobody to say things to me that were wrong or to my children. He was a very protective young man. And I do honestly believe you seen him that night on the platform protecting his friends, saying, "Don't hurt us. Just talk to us." And they didn't. No one gave Oscar. Tried to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Nobody helped Oscar. And I'm asking you today, everybody in here, to help Oscar, help put this officer away before it's your son, your nephew, your cousin, your father, your uncle, your wife, or your daughter. Help put Officer Miserable away. And I thank you, and the family thanks you.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine coming to you from Berkeley, California today. And we are waiting for the arrival of Malik Rahim of Common Ground coming in from New Orleans to talk about a lot of issues. We're going to keep the discussion going on police brutality. We're going to talk about poverty in this country, and we're going to talk about that struggle going on in the Lower Ninth Ward, which really reflects what happens to people when they really try and assert themselves, clean up their own community. They don't often get the help and the support that they need. Malik Rahim is here. We've got a couple of minutes, Malik, and I am delighted that you made it. So sorry that you got caught up in traffic, it's good to have you with us. And
yes, it's always
your good friend Greg Palast says hello to you.
Oh.
We just had him on. We're hoping to have a little reunion on the air.
Oh.
But we're glad to have you with us, and we only have a couple of minutes because it's so late. But let's just go to the core. What's happening? We've got a new president.
Yeah.
It is a historic election.
Yeah.
It is an African-American president. This has not happened before. What does it mean to a community like the Lower Ninth Ward? What's going on?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I look at it as the way it happened when I was in my 20s and 30s when we first started having a black mayor. So I pray that it don't turn out the same with the apathy that wound up prevailing afterward. But as it relates in New Orleans or in the aftermath of Katrina, we have helped get him elected because it was because of what happened after Katrina that the Democrats once again start rising in polls and the Republicans start sinking. So again, we must look at it this way, but we must understand that Obama is the New Deal of our generation. And only reason why the New Deal worked during Roosevelt is because of Upton Sinclair, Elijah Muhammad, the Honorable Marcus Garvey, Huey Long. So we have to become those Huey Long. We have to become the conscience of this nation if we're going to truly make this New Deal
Greg
work.
Greg Palast was talking about Huey Long. It's funny he just said, I want to hear Huey Long in President Obama.
That's right. That's right. We got to hear him. We got to hear this. If we're going to make the difference, and we have to do, we have to all get up off our behinds and roll up our sleeves and understand that he don't have, Obama don't have no magic wand. But we do. We are the ones that we have to once again take control of this nation. And if the progressive segment of this nation's population would take control, then I'm going to tell you, it will be a new deal.
Well, let me tell you this. We've got about 3 minutes left, and I want to, I don't know, how long are you in town for, Malik?
I'm here until, I can't stay until Friday.
Okay. Well, I want you to come back, because I want to get you before you leave. So, in the final couple of minutes on this round, and we'll see if we can get you back in the next couple of days.
Oh, yes.
Because I know lots of listeners want to hear you, but we have 2 minutes. How would you evaluate the United States, the new third world country? How deep is poverty now, and where do you see us going in the context of the so-called financial meltdown?
Well, I believe that we are in a depression. How deep is this depression is, I humbly no one know. But I'll tell you this, we have the ability to uplift ourselves. We are better off now. Economically, we are better off socially, educationally, we are better off, and spiritually, we are better off now than we was in the latter 20s and early 30s. So we can uplift ourselves. But the very first thing we must do is stop fighting these unjust wars.
Really, because it's an obvious resource suck. And if you don't, even if you don't take all the kids and send them over there to get killed, you take the money, you send their money over there, and you turn it into weapons.
Well, it's not only that. Like I said, we love our soldiers, and we send them off to war with love. But we bring them back as veterans, and we are a nation that hate our veterans. So we have to once again start talking about, because as we're sending these guys over, they're coming back traumatically affected by the war. And are we willing to take care of them? Are we willing to make the sacrifice that said that because of the next 50 years that we're going to be able to take care of these soldiers? Or are we going to treat them like we did for the bonus march or after Vietnam?
Or are we going to treat them like we did the victims of Katrina?
That's right. And God knows I hope not. Because if we do, then life as we know it is doomed.
All right. Well, Malik, we're going to, I promise, if I have to track you
Dennis,
down.
I'm sorry. I didn't think California, I forgot all about it. I'm in California. The traffic here is something else.
All right. Well, we want you to experience everything fully. Malik, are you involved in any events that people can see you at?
No, I'm trying to set
you're just
them up.
Doing some
I'm just
organizing.
To, yeah, I'm trying
and talking
to
a lot of people.
California,
okay, well, we're going
to
do some organizing on the air with you in the next couple of days. We'll
and
get
Greg,
you back.
Greg, I'm sorry I didn't catch you on the air, but my heart and love goes out to you.
All right. Malik Rahim's coming back soon. I'm Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. It's called Flashpoints. Again, dbernstein at igc.org. We want to know where you're listening and what about this program is most important to you. Please get in touch with us. That does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. KABU is proud to co-sponsor Al-Andalus Ensemble's Baghdad and 21 Strings Concert and CD release, Saturday, March 28th at 7:30 p.m. The Baghdad performance is a musical memorial to all the people whose lives were lost or destroyed in the War on Terror. Al-Andalus Ensemble is steeped in tradition, merging classical, jazz, and contemporary music with sounds from the Middle East, North Africa, and Spain. That's Al-Andalus Ensemble's performance, 21 Strings, March 28th, at Reed College's Hall Auditorium. More information is available by email, music@andalus.com, that's andalus.com, or by phone, 503-230-2379.
It's 2 minutes to 11 o'clock. You're listening to the Tuesday Radio Zine on KBOO Portland 90.7. Still to come, at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews Vanessa Renwick about her new show at the New American Art Union. Renwick works in experimental and poetic documentary forms and produces films, videos, and installations that explore the possibility of hope in contemporary society. Up next on Stage and Studio, Demay Roberts welcomes guests from Northwest Children's Theater's production of Goodnight Moon, and producer Frank Reynolds talks to people around Portland about funding for the arts and the importance of culture in tough economic times. Welcome to Stage and Studio. I'm Demay Roberts. The classic children's tale, Goodnight Moon, by Margaret Wise Brown, comes to life with music. The Northwest Children's Theater's director and two actors are here today to tell us more about this play. In the past few weeks, we've been covering the arts funding crisis and how it's affected Portland's nonprofit arts companies and groups around town. Now, producer Frank Reynolds took to the streets to ask the public what art means to them and the value of art. That plus a ticket giveaway, so stay with us. This is Stage and Studio.
I'm Dee Mae Roberts. With me in the studio are Sarah Jane Hardy. Good morning.
Good morning.
And with her are two actors, Aidan Young.
Hello.
Good morning. Who plays Bunny, and Leah Zawada. Good morning.
Hi.
Who plays Mouse, and they're all from the Northwest Children's Theater's production of Goodnight Moon by Chad Henry, based on the book by Margaret Wise Brown. Welcome all to stage and studio. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, Sarah Jane, let's start off with Goodnight Moon, the book by Margaret Wise Brown. It was first published in 1947, so it goes back a little ways, and it's been a classic example of the perfect bedtime story, or so I've heard. I haven't read it myself. Now, how did you first learn about this book?
Well, I'm a mother of two children, and I'm not sure if somebody gave us the book or if we picked it up from the library. I grew up in England, and it's not a classic there. So I didn't grow up with the book, but I was introduced to it early on. I have a child who just turned seven, and so when she was a baby, it was part of our bedtime ritual. And I work in theater, so it's mostly her dad that does the bedtime ritual because I'm working in the evenings. And so it was definitely a favorite of hers and of his, reading to her.
Well, it sounds like a really great thing to be read to in the evening to get you to sleep. I think I'll try it so I can get to sleep. Now, Chad Henry adapted it for the stage for the Seattle Children's Theater.
That's correct.
Now, did you see it there?
I did not. I've never seen a production, but I did hear. We are in contact with Seattle Children's Theater regularly, and it was a big hit for them, and their audiences really appreciated it. And quite often, things that work at Seattle Children's Theater will work in Portland. We have a similar, not identical, but similar audience
base. It's nice to have that sister relationship.
It's really nice, yeah.
So how has, has the production changed? Or you wouldn't even know since you didn't see it.
I didn't see it.
What was it about this production that you said you had to do this?
Well, last year in this time slot, we did a production of Go, Dog, Go. And it was the first time that we'd done a main stage production aimed at children that were very young, at the very young audiences. And it went really well, and our audiences let us know that that was something that they really wanted to see. There was a lot of very first-time theater patrons, the 3- and 4-year-olds who've, you know, the first time ever in the theater, and we're hoping that this is the beginning of a lifelong relationship with theater and the arts. And so we tried to find a script that would build on that relationship with our audience so that they could come to rely on Northwest Children's Theater as a place for theater for the very young at this time of year. And Goodnight Moon was such a hit in Seattle, and we've worked with a lot of Chad Henry's work, and that plays very well here. So it just seemed like a really good fit, and I knew the book and loved it.
Well, let's bring Bunny and Mouse into the conversation. In fact, we have Bunny and Mouse in character here with makeup and ears and all kinds of things. So it's great to wake me up in the morning. Would you let's start off with Aidan and you know, tell me about your character.
Well, Bunny is, he's a very young child, obviously, and he's just being introduced to the world around him, and his bedroom is coming to life, and he's learning new lessons, and really just everything's new to him, so I think that's really nice.
And Leo, who is Mouse?
Well, Mouse is really mischievous, kind of like Bunny's sidekick that does all his dirty deeds and, like, that stuff. And
you're the troublemaker, huh?
Yeah, the troublemaker.
Is Mouse. Yeah. Okay, that's your character. I can relate to that. So, you know, you have a song for us. You guys, this is a musical, right? So,
yeah.
Have you sung a lot before, both of you, or is this the first time?
Yeah,
either
one.
No,
I don't care. So you have sung a lot.
Yeah. Fair amount.
Well, tell us about this song. You want to, Sarah Jane, sort of introduce this song for us? And we're going to actually have a little concert here.
Well, the book has probably about 25 words in it. I mean, it's not a long book. And so in adapting it to the stage, Chad Henry brought each of the elements that Bunny says goodnight to life and added the subplot of a tooth being loose that comes out during the run of the show. And this is the moment in which Bunny and Mouse bond over the experience of tooth losing and how they come out and what that feels like.
And the song is called My Tooth is Loose. Great. So this is going to be a song from the Northwest Children's Theater's production of Goodnight Moon.
got loose. It started in to wiggle. My tooth got loose. It then began to jiggle.
I pushed it with my tongue.
Uh-huh.
I tied it with the string.
Uh-huh.
And when the string was strung, we gave the door a fling. Slam! And then my tooth came out, and it didn't hurt a bit.
Some.
It came right out,
and it had to go and spit. Some.
Now we'll look bizarre and funny for a time, but I'll grow another tooth.
And this one's worth a dime.
That's why I am glad my tooth got loose.
Now, put this tooth under your pillow, and the tooth fairy will give you a dime.
Have you ever seen the tooth fairy?
No, he always comes when I'm asleep.
Gee, well, I thought the tooth fairy was a lady.
No, they have man tooth fairies, too. Just depends on who gets the night shift.
Oh, okay. We both stay awake, and if one of us falls asleep, the other one wakes us up. Then, when the tooth fairy comes, we'll grab him.
Yeah. Hey, now can I have some mush?
Oh, all right.
Hey, I think my other tooth is loose.
From Goodnight Moon at Northwest Children's Theater's production, which runs through April 5th at Northwest Children's Theater. Now, you're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts, and we just had a concert, concert, and a song from Aidan Young and Leah Zawada, and their directors here also, Sarah Jane Hardy. Now, this was a lot of fun, and I can picture both of you, you know, singing really out loud like that. That was awesome. How many songs do you guys have?
Counted.
A lot.
I think there's about 11.
11
songs,
songs
in the show.
Wow.
And,
that's a lot.
There's
to,
a recurring theme of the cow attempting to jump over the moon.
I mean, that story came from this book, right? The
yes.
cow jumping over
yes.
the moon?
Apparently.
I thought it was like really, really old, like Mother Goose
Me
time.
Me too, but yeah. apparently not.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's so interesting. That something from the 40s can yeah, you know, evoke that kind of iconic
uh-huh.
mythography.
The right.
Wanted to use them. So this is so interesting that, you know, you said there were like 25 words in this book.
Yes.
And then to create a whole hour-long show with music.
Yeah, and if we hadn't done Go Dog Go last year, I wouldn't have thought it was possible. But I think Go Dog Go had even fewer words in the book and in the production. And yet it played very well. In my experience, young children they live in the moment, and they're not looking for a particularly in-depth linear thread from moment to moment. They're really experiencing things as you present them and evaluating them based on how they receive them in the moment. And so when these individual sections of the room come to life and interact with Bunny, this is something that, if they're familiar with the book, a lot of them have been imagining for themselves for a large percentage of their young lives. And to see that happen on stage really plays well. We've been absolutely delighted with the way our youngest patrons have responded.
Now, are there more characters than Bunny and Mouse?
There is. There's Bunny and Mouse. There's the old lady who whispers hush. There's the three bears that come out of a picture. There's the cow attempting to jump over the moon, and the cat and the fiddle with the fiddle and the dish with the spoon, and the little dog that laughs to see such fun.
The cat and the fiddle's from this book too, or
it's from the picture.
Ah.
It's a nursery rhyme that's based on the picture is based on the nursery rhyme. And then there's the tooth fairy who we meet. There's some star makers that get to turn teeth into stars. Have I missed anybody? I think that might be all. There's also the characters of the room.
Yeah,
there's the character of the moon. There's the character of the telephone, the balloon. A lot of the objects in the room have their puppets, and they have
puppetry in
yeah.
this, too. Mm-hmm. I would imagine the scenic design is really important, too, if they're all coming out pages of a book.
Absolutely. And the book itself, each page is based on an image of the room. And so the set design is based very much on that room, the great green room that was created in the book. And we just had to try and figure out the mechanics of how these things would come to life and how much interaction the bunny would be able to have with them, which was a lot of fun in rehearsal.
Well, I can't believe how much this book has endured, Good Night Moon. I mean, I read, you know, a little bit about it, and it's even been referenced by The Simpsons and Family Guy, if you can believe it, and Mad Magazine. I mean, it seems like this children's book has had a great effect on a lot of people's childhoods.
Absolutely, and I think the author really nailed something when she started writing this book and Runaway Bunny, that she looked at the world from a child's perspective. Rather than telling a child's stories of what it would be like as they were older and the lessons they needed to learn, she tried to capture the experience of a child in their world right now. And Goodnight Moon, I mean, that idea of going around the room and saying goodnight to everything in it as a sort of ritual that occurs every night to help you unwind is something that I'm sure families have been doing for generations. And she captured that and translated it into this beautiful book. And I think that's partially why it was so well received at the time.
So, Aiden and Leah, when did you first encounter this book? Do you even remember?
I don't remember. The last I remember is, like, just reading it when I was a kid and going to bed.
Yeah, I love the book, and I actually read it to my little brothers in Colorado, where they live. And they love the book, too, so, yeah, I have a lot of familiarity with it.
I imagine that both of you came out of the Northwest Children's Theater School, too, or, you know, were you students at first and then sort of worked up, because you're very professional.
You really are. Yeah. They're pros. They've been at it a long time.
Yeah.
They've both been on our stages before. What shows have you been in before, Aiden?
My first main stage production was Swiss Family Robinson, and I was also in The Wizard of Oz.
How about you, Leah?
I've been in Junie B. Jones here and Honk the Ugly Duckling and Go Dog Go, and then this book.
That's quite a few shows.
Hansel and Gretel.
Oh, and Hansel and Gretel.
Oh, my. What a resume. I mean, this is a credit to the school, isn't it, Sarah Jane? I mean, that you really, you know, you have the school, but you also have, I don't want to say a stable. What am I trying to say?
Mm-hmm.
You have a whole group of people, though, that you can call upon to do professional shows.
We do, and I actually credit the city for that. There's an awful lot of arts training in Portland, and we share students and we share performers. And we share them gladly, you know. And Leah and Aiden have both probably done work elsewhere and will continue to do elsewhere and work elsewhere. And they participate in classes, the advanced classes that we have at the Children's Theater when they can. And, yeah, there's a lot of back and forth between our school and our main stage. And the way that we try to conduct our rehearsal process is very educational. So we hope that as the children participate in a main stage show, their education is primary to that experience, and that they're learning. They're learning about themselves, they're learning about art, they're learning about communication, and of course they're learning about theater.
Well, especially since arts programs have been cut so much from the schools that, you know, the public schools, that more and more Northwest Children's Theater is going to be more important to, you know, that kind of education, definitely. And I'm wondering, we've been covering a lot about the economic crisis. How important is it for you to fill these seats in your theater?
It's always really important, but at times like this, it's particularly important. We have not seen a downturn in attendance. In fact, it's been a very positive season for us, tuition and with ticket sales. But where all of the organizations are feeling a cut is in, you know, in corporation giving and to a lesser degree individual giving. And so we're looking to, you know, make up some cuts in those areas by increased ticket sales. And people still, at the moment anyway, touch wood, people are still very much invested in attending the theater.
Well, I know you have a show to get to this morning, so I'm going to give our listeners this information. Good Night Moon by Chad Henry, based on the book by Margaret Wise Brown, directed by Sarah Jane Hardy, runs through April 5th, Saturday and Sunday, plus during this week, spring break, March 24th through the 27th, Tuesday through Friday. All shows are at 12 noon and 3 p.m. at the Northwest Neighborhood Cultural Center at 1819 Northwest Everett Street in Portland. For tickets, call 503-222-4480. That's 222-4480. Or online at nwcts.org. That stands for Northwest Children's Theater School.org. NWCTS. And it's suggested for ages 4 and up. And tickets are $15 to $20 for adults, $10 to $16 for youth, 14 and under. For more info, call 503-222-4480. That's 222-4480. 4480 or visit their website, nwcts.org. We have a family pack of four tickets. What an opportunity, especially during spring break. A family pack of four tickets to offer to the third caller here at KBOO at 503-231-8049. That's 231-8049. Third caller, family pack of four tickets to Goodnight Moon at Northwest Children's Theater. And if you missed any of the show or this interview, you can listen online starting tomorrow at kboo.fm/stageandstudio. And also join our Stage and Studio Facebook page. Sarah Jane Hardy, Aidan Young, and Leah Zawada, it's so great to have you here this morning.
Thank you very much.
Legs all this week during spring break, you know, when you're doing all your matinees and shows. It was so great to meet all of you. And
Thank you very much.
I've met you before, Sarah. Great to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
All right. Well, next up, we hear from the public about the value of arts in Portland's Tri-County. So stay with us. This is Stage and Studio. Listening to Stage and Studio, I'm Dee Mae Roberts. For the last several weeks, we've been examining the state of the arts in Portland's Tri-County's areas. This fiscal year, the Regional Arts and Culture Council awarded individual artists and organizations in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties more than $2 million in project grants and emergency and organizational support. How much RAC, or RACC, will fund this next year is really up in the air as the City of Portland makes its next round of budget cuts. For most artists and organizations, this will certainly be a difficult year. But how does this non-arts community, view artists and arts organizations and what they give back to the community? How does the general public view arts funding? And should it continue to fund arts at a time when there's little government funding to spare? With these questions in mind, Frank Reynolds asked people around town, especially downtown Portland, about state funding for the arts and how culture factors into their lives during tough economic times.
My name is Catherine Gibson. I'm an assistant manager at a dance studio, and I was actually born in Portland, Oregon. Arts need to happen for our communities to thrive. So who should be paying for that if the state doesn't? I have no idea. Is there anybody else? State funds come from our taxes, and so we as people have to choose what to spend the money on. We have a voice, right? I love art. It's inspiring. There's a lot of beautiful people out there with creative minds that the world would be so bland without them.
I'm Ariana Snow, and I currently live in Beaverton. And as far as funding for the arts, I do believe the government should pay or help pay for that, because arts are very important, as we know, you know, from as a child, a young child, I mean, being subjected to it is so important. I mean, you know, they show that, you know, just being smarter. I mean, Mozart, Bach, they had IQs of 160, you know, I mean, it's so important. So cutting that is just, it would be a shame, a true shame. My kids are both very artistic. Thinking that they wouldn't have anything to plug into in the future, it would be just really, really a shame.
My name is Okan Asiat. I'm originally from actually Nigeria. I moved back here from Miami, and I've lived in Portland before. I'm a commodities broker, and I think that funding in arts is very important because I think it really helps stimulate your mind. You know, I think there's a correlation between music, poetry, literature, and intelligence, because I hold two master's degrees, one in Portland State and one in MBA, and I really, really think that playing guitar for me has been not only therapeutic, but also stimulated something in my mind, enabled me to have the discipline to go to school and to perform well in life. So I think the arts, people often overlook the arts, and I think it's a very important part of society because it grounds people in certain ways to stimulate their mind in certain ways that maybe other subjects would not. It's often the things that we need the most that we cut first. Music is needed because it's an outlet for people's, quite often people's anxieties and rage. I know for me personally, guitar has been very therapeutic, you know, in helping me out through hard times. And I think music has a place, a very important place in times of trials and tribulations such as these times that we're going through right now. If it doesn't sink to the rank and file, it doesn't have relevance, especially in times of hardship. So I think it's very important to have the populace participate in art and funding be there for arts. We spend it in other things that are not even relevant or not even productive. I think arts is very productive. It's a constructive thing. I just don't think it should be cut off. You know, I think it's a very important outlet in times of hardship. You know, so quite often when you don't have anything else, you have your music, or you have your poetry, or you have your literature, and it's a part of a healthy man's way of expressing himself. So I think that's an important thing, and especially in times of hardship. You know, I play the blues. I know it's very, you know, the blues is was created because of people expressing their pain. You know, it is a way of surviving very hard times for the African Americans in the South, and I think it's the same thing with music. Music is, expresses times of joy and times of sorrow, and now we're going through some rough times. Hopefully they won't last long.
I'm from Portland, Oregon. My name is Scott Boyles, and I'm a pastry cook. I think that the government could definitely be putting their funds into different and better places. Unfortunately, I don't think that art is the place that should be going. I feel like art is a crucial part of our culture and our society, but not necessarily should be funded by everyone, you know. I think that art should be funded by the people that appreciate the art and want to go and pay for the art and do that, but not necessarily that we should all pay for it with our taxes, you know. Some people, that's not their thing. Why should everyone have to pay for something that they don't necessarily enjoy or want to be a part of?
My name's Rebecca Gulling, and I live in Vancouver, Washington. Quality of life issues are always the ones that are going down the tube, and that really upsets me. So, you know, my daughters and I all have an art background, and that's important to us to have the arts. When there's not money to do other things, a lot of arts, you can, if you have visiting artists or whatever, they're almost free to see, you know? And so I think it's very important, you know, whether it's performing arts or any other kind, if the kids are involved, then it'll continue. Otherwise, these old people that go to, like, the symphony and whatever, they're dying off, and then there will be nothing, you know? So if you don't get the kids involved, it dies.
I'm Doug from Corvallis, and I'm a mechanical designer. I think that the arts should be funded by the public and not dictated by the government how they want to do it. They take our money and use enough of it in a lot of ways that we may not all agree with. And I think it should be something that's done by the people. It used to be that the government was for the people. I don't believe that's the case anymore. And so let the people in the areas that they want to create some art, let them rise up together and create the art. I just think we have the government taking care of too much right now. We, the people, need to take care of it.
I'm V. The arts are good for students. It keeps them grounded, it expands their mind, and it keeps us competing with everybody else. So if we don't get those things, our children can't compete. They're not open to anything. We try to do, like, community stuff and library when it has things. But see, sometimes those things aren't advertised like it should be. People don't go. It goes to a certain group of people, the members, the so-called elite, and then those kids that really need it get cut off. That's just like the school. If they're not sponsoring those things, which it's easy to sponsor, they take it away. They took away, the arts. They took away physical education. Now we got all these lazy people. That, you know, restaurants are just right out their door. No exercise, no nothing. So what would you do? Would you really go look at something? If you got to walk to go do it? And if something else is across the street, they just hand it to you? I don't know. That's the way I see it.
I'm Side Street Rennie. We are currently residing in Portland. We are from Brooklyn, originally.
And I am Little Bell, drummer, and I sing with Side Street Rennie. And I am originally from New York, and now we're here in Portland.
Both my parents were artists, and throughout my life did a lot of different kinds of art that got displayed in a lot of different ways, and public art to me was always the coolest. I mean, I'm old enough to have lost art and music in my schools as I was growing up. So, yeah, I'm really bummed about it, and I really think that the government needs to step it up. What were we saying the other day? When it all crashes, when all the gold doesn't support the money anymore, it's only going to be the people that sell alcohol and us musicians and artists that are going to be the only viable anything at that point. I thought it wasn't the Depression.
Thanks to Frank Reynolds for that report. Now, if you want to help protect arts funding or would like to have your voice heard, check out theartscan.org, theartscan.org. There's also more info and an economic toolkit for artists and organizations at rac.org, RACC.org. Before we go today, an announcement. The book, Knowing Pains, Women on Love, Sex, and Work in Our 40s, Real Stories About Real Women, as seen on NBC's The Today Show, has captured the interest of thousands around the country. Stories by three Portland writers, Anna Aman, and Kim Croft Miller, and Natalie Serber, have made their way into this new book. And they will be joined by editor Molly Tracy Rosen, and that's Saturday, March 28th, from 2 to 2:30 p.m., that's 2 to 2:30, March 28th, to discuss how this book came to life during Portland's Support Women Arts Now Swan Day celebration at the Portland Expo Center at 2060 North Marine Drive in Portland. 100% of the profits from Knowing Pains will be donated to Breast Cancer Action. That's it for Stage and Studio this week. Our engineer is the wonderful Janet Anderson. If you missed any of this show, you can listen online starting tomorrow at kboo.fm/stageandstudio. And also be check out the Stage and Studio Facebook page, too, for updates to each week's program. Now, if you want to be a guest on the show or have an event you'd like to tell me about, write me at stage@aol.com. That's stage@aol.com. Till next week, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
Good morning. This is Ava Lake, and you're listening to Art Focus. Thanks so much for following us to our new time slot. If you missed the last few shows, because we're now here on Tuesday mornings, you can always go to our website. I'm building a little homepage at kboo.fm/artfocus. Now, you can see I'm uploading past interviews, providing links to galleries, to artists' websites, and posting a few images. Currently on show at the New American Art Union, which is right around the corner from KBOO here in Southeast Portland, there's an installation and exhibition called House of Sound. When I walked into the room beyond the velvet curtain, I saw first a fairly inviting couch and chairs with a record player and a nice selection of records to play. You're encouraged to play the music there if you want, but there's already sound and audio that's in progress. Conversations about a building, about a business, a record store called House of Sound. Along with this, there's a video, which provides actually a pretty sharp contrast to the audio, footage of bleak, barren, urban space. There's a sign from a shop from bygone days called House of Sound. The artist is an award-winning filmmaker known for her documentary film, which is used in poetic ways, often part of larger installations which refer to social changes in locale. They're site-specific, often interactive. She's also known as the founder of the Oregon Department of Kick-Ass. She's got a website, www.odoka.org. Vanessa Renick, thanks so much for coming to KBOO and Art Focus.
It's an honor to be on your show, Ava. Thanks a lot. Happy spring to everybody out there in Radio Land.
Yeah. Well, you've been on KBOO a couple of times, yes?
Yes.
With Julie?
With Julie, yes.
Okay. Any other shows or?
I was for just a pipsqueak of a moment on Eugene Rashad's show on February 14th of this year, which was a show dedicated to the memory of the House of Sound.
Right. Okay. So you've already had a little bit of play here about what we're gonna talk about.
Yes.
So the House of Sound was a business primarily and a building. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And from what I understand, this building was torn down on New Year's Day of 2008. Right?
Yes.
Okay. So my first question for you is: when did you first know that this was going to be somehow, that event and the history of that event would become a project for you? Like, how did that develop?
Well, I think it actually goes back to before the actual House of Sound idea, when about 2 or 3 years ago at the corner of Fremont and Williams and Vancouver, a developer had bought the lots where the Big O Tire was and where that gas station is and where the drive-thru dairy used to be, the Sims drive-thru dairy. And they had put up these light green rectangular markers with very faint white text on it, and they were far away from the sidewalk, kind of in the middle of the field, and unless you walked into the field, you couldn't really tell what they are. And I came up with the idea to take the highway sign, the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail sign, and take that image of the two of them pointing, it's a silhouette, mm-hmm. and instead of saying Historic Lewis and Clark Trail underneath, I put the words gentrify. And I was going to spray paint it on those markers, but I didn't get around to cutting the stencil, and then suddenly the markers were gone. And so I was thinking about the buildings being torn down in the neighborhood and the history disappearing for a couple of years, because things have been disappearing there and changing drastically.
So this house is, this was certainly not the first time you noticed it, but sort of the after quite a few.
Yes, mm-hmm. and I live right there, Sabin neighborhood, and go by that intersection at least at least 20 times a week. So I'm constantly seeing the change that's happening. And I was thinking of that also with change being such a big word in Obama's campaign. At one point I was thinking of naming the House of Sound piece Change, talking about the change that I see happening. But the House of Sound itself was so enigmatic that I just had to go with the House of Sound, because I actually wasn't going to make a piece about the House of Sound. And a year ago,
I asked Brian Borello to come with me to go and steal the House of Sound sign, because the building had been boarded up for about probably 6 or 7 years at this point, and there was more graffiti on that building happening than I had ever seen on any building in Portland, and I was really worried about that sign getting tagged and ruined. I had seen a show at Reed College about a moment where I think it was in the late 60s, although it might have been the 70s, where the black students had done a sit-in because they wanted to have more black history classes, and they had created a newspaper for that sit-in, and it was on black paper screen printed with silver ink, and it was one of the most beautiful silk-screened pieces of paper I'd ever seen, and at the bottom of the newspaper there was an ad for the House of Sound, and I knew that that sign was really important to the history of the black people in Portland, and that it should not get messed up, and it needed to be saved sometime. And Brian Burrell and I went out there, and we looked at it, and it's this huge 8-foot sign, and we would need a cherry picker to get it down, and we decided we couldn't do it, and I just kind of fretted about it on and off. And then in November or December of last year, I read in the Oregonian that it was an article about the changes on Williams Avenue happening and how Jay's lawnmower might have to move because the rents are going up, and just how it's really manufacturing and places that fix things are disappearing and everything's getting replaced with cafes and restaurants, and I don't know how it's going to sustain itself in this economy. But at the end of that article, it mentioned that the House of Sound building was coming down. And I immediately just, like, almost had a heart attack. My heart was racing so fast. And it was funny because I was in a restaurant at the time having breakfast, and I saw Charles Bedford sitting across the restaurant from me. And he owns the Going Street Market, and I've known him for probably 18 years. And he used to work at the House of Sound and was very sad that it came down. I was actually crying when the building was being torn down. And I had been told by my friend Michael Brophy, who lives across from the Going Street Market, don't talk to Charles about the building. Because I had said to Michael earlier, I want to get the sign. He was like, don't talk to Charles about it. He's too torn up about it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to ignore what Michael said. I have to find out who bought the building. And I went up to Charles, and he told me it was this developer. And I tracked him down on the internet and called him up and gave him this long sob story spiel. And he was like, yeah, you can get the sign, and I'm happy that it's going to go back into the community, because after the show, the sign is going to stay in the neighborhood. And I got the sign.
Did they take it down for you? Or
Yeah, they took
okay.
it down.
All right. It's good.
And since then, and I knew it came down during the snowstorm, and the guys who took it down just left it in the lot. I wasn't home. And they were like, it's okay, it's in the lot. And I'm like, they don't understand how many people want that sign.
Yes.
And I went the next morning, and there was another dump truck company there taking the rubble away from the cement building that was next door to the House of Sound. And I told them, I'm here to get the sign. They didn't know what I was talking about. And I ran around the neighborhood and actually got Michael Brophy and this other guy to come and help me. It was really early in the morning, and we got the sign and brought it to my house. And then we went back to the Going Street Market, and I was, like, screaming at the top of my lungs. I was so happy. And Charles was talking to me about making a movie about the House of Sound, which, how many times in your life do you have people coming up to you going, you should make a movie about blah, 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 and has it ever happened? No. And I said to Charles, Charles, there's no movie here. The building is gone. The image is gone. No.
So by the time, by the time you had the conversation, the building had come down.
Yes. And the building was actually still up that day.
Okay. But it was going to be down soon.
And the sign was in my backyard.
Uh-huh. So someone's offering you this idea.
Yeah.
Kind of.
And then the next, I thought about it. I left. And the next day I went back to Charles. And I was like, Charles, it should be a radio show. And my friend Erin Yankee does a show on KABU. And she also does these standalone releases on CDs with scenes that have people talking and music played in between, and it would be really great to get the House of Sound guys together, and it would work really well. And then I didn't talk to Charles for a while, and then Charles had talked to one of the guys, Cleo Smith, who also worked at the House of Sound, and he had talked to Eugene Rashad about doing it. And then the House of Sound alumni ended up coming here to KABU on Valentine's Day and doing the show with Eugene, which was really better than it would have been with Aaron Yankee, because Eugen had been at the House of Sound,
yes,
and knew the history, and everybody,
yes,
felt comfortable with each other, and it was a five-hour tribute show. And I came in and just spoke a little about the show I was doing, and they were all very excited about it.
So by that time in February, when you were a part of this interview, you were in the process of already shooting footage of this bare space, the absence of the place.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I came up with the idea that it could be an installation, and that it would work, and it would be really strong without the building there,
mm-hmm,
and to just show the emptiness of the empty lots that are there now, but hearing these really rich stories of what went on and what a great community space the House of Sound was.
Well, I thought actually that contrast was really, really effective. I mean, the absence of it was, especially because the sign is there and it kind of functions as the big reminder and is almost a ghost in some ways. And then, I mean, it's very real, but at the same time, well, you've got these candles. You've got all these candles around it. So were you kind of elevating it to icon status, or what's the deal
with
the boat is?
It is an icon in a way that, like, I had been poo-pooing the idea of making the piece, and maybe it was the probably sixth or seventh person that I was talking to about the House of Sound coming down and,
mm-hmm,
my saving of the sign, where the person would just go, oh my God, the House of Sound, it came down. I love that building. I had so many, you know, fantasies about what could happen in there or what happened in there. And finally, I got pushed over the edge by hearing that. And I was like, it's true. So many people were attached to that building, even people that didn't shop at the House of Sound or,
mm-hmm,
or had moved here after it had been closed down. The building had an amazing draw to,
mm-hmm,
it. And that's what made me turn it into this. It is people who know of that. I mean, so many people since then, I've heard too from other people, have tried to steal the sign. There were two metal rods missing on either side of the sign when we got it that looked like somebody had removed them and were going to try to steal the plexiglass panels out of it, but it was impossible without unscrewing all the other panels. A lot of people did look at that building in an iconic way.
Well, you know, another thing, too, about the actual footage, I'm just curious, like, how you made your choices or decided to show what you did. You know, what I saw when I looked at the images, okay, I saw, nonetheless, your style. And maybe I haven't seen enough film to know exactly what that is, but it's really graphic to me, and it's very reduced, and you can read a lot in it, and it is ART, and how do you choose, like, the images? You must have shot a lot. How did it all become so, like, montage in every way? It was, I thought it was quite powerful, but I'm wondering how you came to choose what you did.
Well, Eric Edwards shot it. It's shot on 35mm film, and we actually only shot about 12 minutes,
mm-hmm,
of footage, and I think 10 minutes made it into the piece, and it is doubled during the show, so you actually watch the same footage twice while you're sitting there listening to the 20 minutes of audio, which I edited down from the five-hour show that Eugen Rashad had. And it was, I had worked with Eric also on shooting the film about Trojan coming down,
mm-hmm,
and I think there's a really playful, fun element that comes working between us, where I am pretty open and we're both really relaxed when we're shooting and happy, and I'm super excited, and I know, you know, I just want shots of, you know, I want a driving shot, or I want a walking shot, or let's go up, mm-hmm, on this balcony. And Eric has the real expertise of which lens to use, and it's a very give and take between us, and it almost got edited in the camera. I think changed two shots, but I pretty much used it the way for the House of Sound piece. We shot it in the camera. I was joking with Eric that it was the most difficult thing he probably has ever shot, because it's hard to shoot an empty lot. There's only so many ways you can look at the empty lot.
Well, you're trying to make us look at it, though, aren't you, and not take it for granted.
Right.
Like, this is what, we gave up this cool thing for this, but we tend to not look at it when it's there.
Which it's going to turn into a 70-unit condo, supposedly, whenever the economy turns around. Or that's what it said in the newspaper article.
And that could be a while.
Yeah.
That could be a while.
Do you still hear rumors there's going to be a Trader Joe on Fremont? Oh. Who knows any of this? The Wonder Bread factory gone. All these things gone. The Tropicana restaurant is still there, and it's being surrounded by some new condos called the Blueberry something or other, 90% green-made condominiums. But the Tropicana is going to be there nestled within it. And I had somebody talk to me about how they'd never gone into the House of Sound, and now that it's gone, they really wish they had.
I wish they had.
It's like, I'm telling you, you should go into the Tropicana. You should go into these places that you are just going by and ignoring, mm-hmm. and patronize them and keep them around.
Want to remind you that you are listening to KBOO Portland, and I'm Ava Lake. You're listening to Art Focus, and we're talking to Vanessa Renick, who has an exhibition that's up right now at the New American Art Union, and it's called House of Sound. And so there's audio, there's the visual, there's the video. I also want to talk to you a little bit about the rest of it. I want to talk to you about the records. So are the records, so as you sit down, you can sit down on this sofa, on this couch, and you can listen to records, or you can just listen to the audio. Tell me about the choice of music. Was that curated in, like, what, or was that found, or like, tell me about that.
It was,
I like that.
Very much curated in.
Okay.
And people can listen to the records while still listening to the gentleman speaking on the KBOO broadcast. You can have the music low enough, and it works well listening to both at the same time. Or there's 10 minutes built into the end of the piece where the piece is not being projected. You're not listening to the men, and you could just hang out and play records. I talked to David Dawson, who is the surviving owner of the House of Sound, and asked him to give me a suggestion of songs and records to have there that would have been, you know, really popular during his time at the House of Sound. And he sent me a list, and then I gave that to Eric Isaacson at Mississippi Records. And he also, when he opened his shop on the corner of Mississippi and Shaver, he said many people in the community came and brought their collections of records to him to sell, and a lot of them had the House of Sound price tags on them, and they were actually bought from the House of Sound. And he had specifically went through, and because he remembered which those were, and picked some of those out. And so it's a mix of both the memories of David Dawson and the expertise and knowledge of Eric Isaacson bringing those records together.
Nice, really nice. Now, with the audio that's up, you're saying that this came from 5 hours that was here on KBOO?
Yes.
Or, okay, and then you took down like 20 minutes conversation from that?
Yes.
Or 10 minutes? Or
20 minutes,
20
yes.
minutes, okay. How easy was that for you? Did you put together was it about favorite stories, or was it about making sure that people understood the trajectory of this, you know, because I heard definite parts where, like, people are just really reminiscing and talking about how great it was to be there. And
I actually came up with a new way of editing audio by mistake, or by happenstance, where when Charles Bedford called me up the day before the show on KBOO to tell me it was happening, and I wanted to come down to the show and talk about my piece and meet everybody, and was so excited that it was happening. And so I called up a bunch of my friends and asked them, can you record the show? Because I don't know if they're going to record it.
Mm-hmm.
And a few people ended up recording it on audio cassette, and Erin Yankee gave me 3 cassettes that had most of the show on it, and she missed like the first 20 minutes of it. And that was all I had to listen to for a while until I got the copy from KBOO, which was a couple of weeks later. And I had it in my van, and I was driving around trying to find elements for the show or going to interview different people. And whenever I was running an errand or driving somewhere, I was listening to the show, which was great because I didn't have to be sitting in front of my computer listening
yes.
to the audio. And I was just listening to it all the time. And it was such a fun show to listen to because there was music in between it. And I really got intimate with the hours and hours, and it was very easy for me then to know which stories to put in. And I really wanted to put in a cross-section of just to get the feeling of how it was in the neighborhood at that time, and how that store was responsible for such a great feeling of community in the neighborhood as well. And I hope that comes across.
Well, now you moved into the neighborhood 89?
89.
Was it still open then or no?
It was open then.
Was open then. Do you remember going in there then?
I went in there a few times.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
It was different then. It wasn't just a record store. There was
what happened. It became other stuff, right?
Yeah. It kind of changed around. There was Willie owned a barbershop, and then there was the Doris Cafe moved in later next door, and there were those two Victorian houses. There was kind of like a corner store, grocery store, William Street Market there. So it was more not just focused on the records, and it was a mix of different things.
And from what I understand, maybe I saw this on the website, are you still collecting stories?
Yeah. David Dawson, the owner, was very kind to drive up to Portland twice. He lives about an hour south of here, and I have more audio of him, some really great stories, but I wasn't able to cut it into this piece at the House of Sound because it just sounded too different from the radio show. But that will be put into Aaron Yankee and myself and some other people are going to go ahead and make a standalone CD and maybe a zine as well to go along with it, collecting more stories. And if you do want to tell some stories, you can contact Aaron at 503-231-8032 extension 221 to schedule an interview, and we can collect memories or stories or legend or lore and get it into the CD, and anybody who does contribute would get a copy of the CD.
I'm curious, where would be this sounds kind of, I don't know, a weird question, but, you know, when something is so documentary as this, where does it end up? I mean, you kind of think, okay, there's the Oregon Historical Society, which is losing all of its, the library's losing all of its funding, but, like, what would be the ultimate archive for this kind of work that
you're
doing?
Well, I'm actually going to cut the film portion of it down to about a 10-minute piece, and it's going to become portrait number 3, part of my portrait series, and it will probably go around the world being shown, and the portrait series eventually will be many, many pieces all about the Northwest. And
nice.
And so historically, I'm hoping to collect a lot of different stories.
You're making quite an archive, yes.
I also wanted to give a plug. There's an amazing poem at the end of the piece.
Okay.
And that was by Juan, who was sitting here with the guys, and he just came up with, wrote the poem during the five-hour show, and it's mind-blowing. And he's going to be at the IFCC on Sunday night for the Due North celebration, awards ceremony, and he's going to be reciting some more poems there this Sunday night, and it starts at 8 o'clock is the awards ceremony.
Do you have the poem there?
No, I don't have the poem. The poem is in the piece.
Maybe you wanted to... Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So go to the New American Art Union, 922 right. South East Ankeny. It's open Thursday through Sunday from 12 to 6, and it's free.
And how long is your... There are 6-week exhibitions, yes?
Yeah, it's up 4 more weeks till April 19th. And the piece starts pretty much at the top of the hour and at the half-hour mark and runs for 20 minutes, and then there's a 10-minute break. So if you want to get there at the beginning, either come at the head of the hour or at the half-hour mark.
And also,
you can stay there for hours. I heard that some people have stayed for 2 hours just hanging out there.
It's pretty cozy.
Yeah.
It's pretty cozy. But when it travels, let's say when it goes other places, is it going to be just the film and the audio, or are you going to try to get the whole installation to somehow...
It will probably just be the film and the audio, because the sign will not exist anymore. The sign
What's going to happen to that sign?
The sign is a two-sided sign, and one side is going to be cut off into a light box, and it's going to go into Charles Bedford's Going Street Market. And the other side will go into Mississippi Records. So it will be in a record shop again, and it will also be in a store. Both those places, I think, are probably the most community building places in the neighborhood where if you go into that place, you know the people who own them. They know you. You know lots of people shopping there.
Yes.
And it's a big meeting place. And I'm really happy the sign is going to go into both those places.
Also, just wanted to, you know, make the observation or whatever that, you know, most of your work is collaborative, no? I mean, like, do you have any projects where, like, you just do it all and that's it? It seems to me like almost everything, you've got a group of people that are doing what
yeah.
your stuff.
Well, that's pretty much where filmmaking is
yes.
most filmmaking is about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But also, for instance, the other things that you had, for instance, in that installation, right down to the records.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of co-curated, let's put it that way.
Right. The couch I borrowed from somebody, the records, the speaker cabinets, the turntable were from Mississippi Records. And, yes, Eric Edwards helping out. When I go ahead and make the standalone film piece, the Evolutionary Jazz Band is going to be composing some new music to fit in underneath the tracks. And many, many people helped me out on my work, and I could not make it without the help of everybody who works on the pieces. There's a full list of the credits of everybody who's worked on the piece at the gallery.
Yes, people who helped you. Just one other question. Organ department of Kick-Ass, all right. Does it have any function, or does it do things that are separate, let's say, from your separate projects? Does it have something that's all of its own? I'm just kind of curious. The website.
The website is,
yes.
No, it's just really a collection of all the different things that I put out into the world.
Mm-hmm. So, and once again, that's
oka.org.
And there's links for all your past things too. I mean,
yes.
Is it easy for people to assess, you know, information about your past films and all that?
Some of them, the older stuff, I don't have the images or
right.
great description of. The newer stuff, there's a lot of information, a lot of links.
Can you see any of it online?
Yeah, it's all online.
It's all
on
the films,
website.
The films.
Oh, there's only two films on my website right
yeah.
now.
Have you thought about putting that on YouTube or anything?
No, I don't like YouTube.
No? Oh, interesting.
I like looking at YouTube.
Yeah.
But I don't like the way my stuff looks on YouTube.
Okay, yeah, because it's not very sharp, huh?
Or there's this huge white page around it.
Yes,
and
I
all
understand.
This advertising and
yeah.
YouTube logo.
And what are you planning for the future? Like, what's down the pipeline for you?
The next thing I'm doing is finishing this standalone film of The House of Sound. And I am working on a DVD compilation of my own work, which hopefully will be out this summer. It's called North, South, East, West, mm-hmm. All Over the Map, the films of Vanessa Renick.
Wow.
And I will probably be going on tour with it in the fall.
And what would that include? Okay, that would be maybe the Trojan thing?
There'll be a lot of films on it. I've made
okay.
over 37 films and video installations.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be pretty much my favorite films and documentations of installations.
One thing that just hit me, all right, do you feel that there are two separate worlds for you, two different things that you're straddling? One is, for instance, film, pure film, okay, and then this installation and all this other stuff that you do, which is, you know, I mean, film is a part of it, but there's all these other things going on. Kind of two different worlds you're going into, film and art.
I just look at it all as art.
You look at it all as art, and when you, like, say, get into film festivals and things like that, that's all. It's all one for you.
Yes.
Good. Wow. Pretty interesting. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ava.
Yeah, yeah. So please check out the House of Sound, which is at the New American Art Union. And it's there throughout the rest of this month. And
through April 19th.
Through April 19th. And you can get more information at their website, which I believe is www.naau.org.
I think so.
I believe so. All right. And you can find out more about this show if you go to kboo.fm/artfocus. Wanted to let you know that next week I have Chris Haberman with me. He's going to have a show at the Launchpad Gallery. I had Ben Pink on not that long ago, so you should know already quite a bit about that gallery. But he also curates events and shows all over town. He curates into Olympic Mills. So both Launchpad and Olympic Mills are here in Southeast Portland. We're kind of having a Southeast Portland day. So thanks so much for listening to Art Focus, and I'll be talking with you next week.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. We're just 20 seconds shy of noon. Coming up next, we have headline news. We have the KBOO Community Calendar. And then we have a music show called Music Hall Days. So stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Monkey Presents, presenting French rumba, salsa, and flamenco band, the Gypsy Kings, live in concert, Sunday, September 6th at McMiniman's Edgefield. Gypsy Kings tickets are on sale this Saturday, March 28th, at all Ticketmaster outlets, the Crystal Ballroom box office, or Ticketmaster.com. Information at edgefieldconcerts.com.
This news brief brought to you by the International News Net.
Ugandan rebels of the Lord's Resistance Army hacked 12 people to death with machetes and kidnapped 40 more in a remote Congolese village. South Africa barred Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, from entering the country to take part in a peace conference. Local media said the Dalai Lama's visit was refused due to pressure from the Chinese government. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has revealed some 60,000 civilians, including shop managers and council workers, have been trained to deal with terrorist attacks.
Top of the hour news brought to you by INN World Report.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner announced Monday the Treasury is planning to buy up toxic assets using low-interest loans to private investors. The plan is to offer generous subsidies to coax investors into forming partnerships with the government to buy toxic assets from the bank. Critics say the idea that auctioning the assets to the highest bidder will protect the taxpayers' forced investment is nonsense. Critics point out if the assets had any real worth, they would not be considered toxic to begin with. The goal is to leverage the dwindling resources of the bailout program to buy up as many of these toxic assets as possible, freeing the banks to make much-needed loans. Geithner provoked scathing criticism from investors in February by announcing the broad outlines of the plan without addressing the tough questions, like sharing the risk with investors or arriving at a price that would neither cheat taxpayers nor harm the banks.
News and exclusive interviews, see the complete International News Net World Report each weekday evening on Free Speech TV, 9415 Dish Network, or visit our website, inworldreport.net.
Stay tuned.